Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush said today he's open to any ideas or suggestions regarding Iraq. Well, we'll speak to a career diplomat and a military analyst in a moment. But first, all eyes are on Virginia for official confirmation of the outcome of Tuesday's election. Republican incumbent Senator George Allen is expected to speak at 3 p.m. East Coast time today. If he concedes, it will mean that Democrats will control both houses of Congress for the first time in 12 years. Democrat Jim Webb has claimed victory and has already released his first statement to the press as Virginia's senator-elect. Joining us now, Washington Post reporter Michael Shear. And Michael, the AP declared Jim Webb the senator-elect yesterday by a 7,000-vote margin. But we understand there's more canvassing or vote recounting going on today. So what's the latest number and what's the law?
Hey, Robin, how are you? The law in Virginia requires or allows a candidate who has lost an election by a margin smaller than 1% to go ahead and request a recount. But it does not allow the candidate to do that for several weeks. What happens in that interim is that the state election officials across the state and local counties and cities spend time kind of cleaning up the vote, making sure that it's right, double-checking their addition, they do that whether the race is close or not. Obviously, it only really matters all that much when the race is really close. At the end of that period, which takes about 3 weeks to certify the vote, the candidate, is allowed at that point to go ahead and request a recount. All indications are, however, that we're not going to get anywhere near that. It looks very much from the folks that I've talked to and my sources like the senator will go ahead and concede the race at 3 o'clock today.
Well, then tell us a little more about Jim Webb, a former Republican who now appears to be among the more conservative Democrats headed to Congress. A little more about who he is.
Yeah, he's an interesting fellow. He was a Vietnam War hero. I mean, one of those legitimate heroes who was wounded very decorated fellow, came back from Vietnam, describes himself as having turned away from the Democratic Party of his youth and towards the Republican Party at the time because of the Democratic Party's stance on Vietnam, became a U.S. Navy Secretary, Assistant Secretary of Defense under the Ronald Reagan administration, and then became sort of an author, wrote several novels based on his Vietnam experience, and taught for a while at the Naval Academy, and was a Republican this whole time. Didn't change until the Iraq War, when he really took one of the early positions against this war that we're in, and says that that led him away from the Republican Party and to the Democratic Party when he announced for the Senate just a few days ago. A few months ago.
What are some of the issues that he might end up butting heads with Democrats over?
Well, you know, it's interesting. He is probably more conservative on some of the fiscal issues. He has described himself as a fiscal conservative. He is likely to, is not supportive of of gay marriage and that kind of thing. So on some of the social issues as well. But he really did, talk in very, sort of sweeping terms during the campaign. Didn't get much coverage, but he talked about sort of a populist message, in which trying to, talk against the difference between rich and the poor in the country. And I think in that area, he might get along with some of the liberals as well.
Well, and as we said, he's already issued his first official statement. It was praising President Bush's decision to accept the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld. Washington Post reporter Michael Shear, thanks so much for being with us.
Have a good day.
You too. Well, now a view of Iraq and ultimately of the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld. In August of 2003, 30-year-old Rory Stewart, a Farsi-speaking British diplomat of Scottish descent, found himself with near absolute authority over 850,000 Iraqis as deputy governor in the remote and impoverished marshland of the southern Iraq, home to the Shiite majority that the Secretary of Defense and Washington assumed would be grateful collaborators in a transition to democracy. Stewart had served in the British Foreign Services in the Balkans and had recently finished walking across Afghanistan, a journey he documented in the best-selling book, The Places in Between. The people in the marshlands once lived simply, tending buffalo from floating reed platforms, their lives documented by British explorer Sir Wilfred Thesiger. Center. They ultimately rose up against Saddam Hussein in the 1990s. Saddam retaliated, draining the marshes, turning that lush land into a desert. Well, when Rory arrived, he encountered police who suggested plucking out the eyes of transgressors, Iranian spies, Iraqis who dropped car batteries into the Tigris to electrocute and catch fish. At times, his story reads as if Peter Sellers wandered into Lawrence of Arabia.
An American democracy expert came from Baghdad to do capacity building with the local council. On a whiteboard, he drew an oblong on its side to represent the council, and then beneath it, four vertical oblongs to represent its subcommittees. "He is drawing a dog," said a sheikh. "Are we back in primary school?" asked another. "We are an ancient civilization," said one cleric, "and they treat us like Congo cannibals." "Welcome to your new democracy," said the democracy expert. "I have met you before. I have met you in Cambodia. I have met you in Russia. I have met you in Nigeria." At the mention of Nigeria, two of the sheikhs walked out.
Rory Stewart's new book is called The Prince of the Marshes and Other Occupational Hazards of a Year in Iraq, and he joins us now in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
The list of characters. List some of those characters for us as they float up in your memory.
There was a sheikh who used to come into my office and say, "My name is Sa'ad bin Abdul Wahid bin Faleh bin Majid bin Khalifa. My grandfather was in a boat with Wilfred Thesiger in 1953. Please build a clinic in my area." He would then be followed by his cousin who would come in and say, "My name is Muhammad Abbas Muhammad al-Arabi. It was my grandfather who was in the boat with Wilfred Thesiger. Please build a school in my area." And then I would have 3,000 people outside the door with huge banners. And I'd invite in the ringleaders and I'd say, "Hello, please sit down." And I'd know these people. They were people who I would have lunched with, dined with, and they would say, "Mr. Rory Stewart, I would like to read you our petition." And I'd say, "Okay, please read the petition." And they would go, "At last the scaly mask has fallen from the leathery face of the great Satan and the little Satan and their ally Israel and that idiot Mr. Paul Bremer and that donkey Mr. Rory Stewart." At which point I would try to find out what it was they actually wanted. And often people were not that clear about what they wanted. They wished to express their objection to a foreign military occupation in their country, but didn't necessarily have specific requests in terms of the kind of reconstruction projects they wanted us to do. They were just uncomfortable with the whole setup.
How would you characterize what was going on here? Was it Iraqis trying to scam you, Iraqis trying to figure out what they were supposed to do?
Essentially, Saddam had hollowed out Iraqi society, taken all the power into the center, and suddenly we had destroyed that administration. What emerged in a province like Misan was virtually chaos. 54 new political parties had emerged in 4 months. Even an Iraqi would struggle to distinguish between Harakat Dawa, Hizbi Dawa Islamiyya, Hizbi Dawa Tanzim al-Iraq, which is to say the Islamic Core movement, the Islamic Core Muslim Party, the Islamic Core Iraq tendency, let alone distinguish between groups that called themselves Hamas or Hezbollah and consisted of 3 men in a briefcase or 14 different tribes, each with 3 different candidates. So some people were confused. Other people were gangsters. Other people were just chancers, opportunists looking for some opportunity to get their hands on the $10 million of cash I was being given every month to hand out. This cash was delivered to me in vacuum-sealed packets, huge bricks. There was very little requirement for contracts, invoices, and receipts, and we were being encouraged to spend it as quickly as possible. Other people, of course, were Islamists with very strong religious ideologies, and still others, and this was the most difficult thing to adjust to, were genuinely honest, honorable people who wished to build a better Iraq. And of course, after 9 or 10 months, I became increasingly cynical and therefore often missed my opportunities to deal with people who were genuinely good, progressive individuals. The work was surreal, partly because neither the coalition nor the Iraqis really had a clear idea on what we were supposed to be doing. The argument was that Iraqis needed time to prepare for elections, there should be voter education, there should be proper registration programs, which forced us in the situation of trying to select the Iraqi government rather than elect it. And this was bizarre because we had effectively banned most of the previous politicians from standing. It would be like trying to create a government in Columbus, Ohio, while saying we refuse to have any Democrats or Republicans serving on this council. So you end up saying, well, we'll have some businessmen, we'll have some tribal sheikhs, we'll have a poet,
The baker's a good guy.
Yeah, the baker's a good guy. Why don't we have four women? Oh, yes, we need a representative of the Sabian religion, which is a religion dedicated to the cult of John the Baptist. And we'll put them all together on a group. And, of course, the Iraqis would object. They'd say, what on earth are you doing? Who are these people? Why are they there? This man has spent 20 years in Iran. We don't even know who he is. This man is a paid agent of the Iranian government. This is a radical cleric who's calling for revolution against the coalition. And we'd say, well, are you saying then you would have put different people on the council? And generally the response was, not so much saying that. Our problem with this council is that you chose it. One of the problems that we've had is that we went into Iraq saying there is no necessary connection between pain and truth. In other words, you don't need to torture people to get information. And Iraqis didn't believe us. They challenged us again and again and said, this is nonsense. How on earth are we supposed to get information out of people without torturing them? We were pushing back against this, and the tragedy in Iraq is that we failed to prove our point. We failed to prove our case. We failed to actually show Iraqis that we could, as all our police trainers claimed, keep security in a more democratic, human rights-friendly environment.
And you write Abu Ghraib didn't help. The title of the book, The Prince of the Marshes, who was he?
He defines the kind of friends we have in Iraq. He's a total paradox. A heroic guerrilla leader who, on one occasion, when sitting in a restaurant having his breakfast, the Ba'ath Party tried to come in and arrest him, and he took out a hand grenade and calmly put it on the table next to his bread and said, if you come any closer, I'll detonate this hand grenade, killing me, you, and the rest of the restaurant. And they left him alone, and he finished his breakfast. On the other hand, a man who presented himself as a great friend of the coalition, a great opponent of Iran, a great opponent of the Sadrists, and then suddenly 6 months later would swap sides and team up with Muqtada Sadr and start pushing for the coalition to leave. A man who portrayed himself as believing in a human rights-friendly, democratic Iraq, but on another occasion would turn up to break a strike, hitting people himself personally with Kalashnikovs around the head. Known as the Prince of the Marshes, although he wasn't really a prince and there weren't many marshes left, known by the Iraqis as Abu Hatim, father of Hatim, although he in fact had no children at all. In other words, I think in that character is summed up so much of the charm, the generosity, the honour, the violence, and the difficulty of interacting on a day-to-day level with people in southern Iraq.
Of course, the Prince of the Marches would ultimately throw a goodbye party for you when you were reassigned to Nasiriyah, and you were not invited. We're speaking with Rory Stewart, author of Prince of the Marches. It chronicles his time as acting governor in southern Iraq, a place Lawrence of Arabia served as well. He tells incredible tales of visiting the Green Zone, you know, walking by the head of the Red Cross. He had a meeting with him later. Later, that man would be killed by a suicide bomber. His friend, the human rights activist Marla Rusica, killed by a roadside bomb. We'll be back with Rory's thoughts on Donald Rumsfeld's strategy in Iraq, his thoughts on troop withdrawal. Stay with us. Much more ahead with Rory Stewart, here and now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now, and we're speaking with Rory Stewart about the time he spent as acting deputy governor of two provinces in southern Iraq. Rory was born in Hong Kong in 1973, raised in Malaysia, and educated at Eton and Oxford. A career diplomat, he's the son of a retired diplomat. He'd often call him for help, and you increasingly had to do that. You paint an increasingly dismal picture.
Now, of course, when Iraqi governments have taken power, particularly the elected provincial governments in the south, they're beginning to implement security strategies which are not very different from those of Saddam. And one of the saddest things about this invasion, from my point of view, is that to some extent I think we've discredited the idea of democracy.
I'm thinking of different times you had to say to someone, no, it's a democracy, we have to vote on this, or you have to meet as a...
Let me give you an example. In 2004, a large crowd gathered outside my building with banners saying, death to the governor. And we just appointed a new Iraqi governor. And he came into the office and he said, clear this crowd away. And we said, no, they've got permission to demonstrate, freedom of speech, freedom of association. And one of my colleagues said, look, in Britain, often we have thousands of people demonstrating outside the parliament buildings. You're just going to have to get used to it. And he said, this isn't Britain. and his police cordon then opened fire and five people were killed. We put British troops between the crowd and this now empty building where they stood for 6 or 7 hours with improvised explosive devices being thrown at them. Towards the evening, the crowd seemed to go away, the troops went home, but when I walked over to the Iraqi governor's office the next morning, I discovered the whole building had been looted from end to end. Found the governor sitting at the only piece of furniture which had been too heavy for the looters to remove, and he said, "What on earth's going on?" And my colleague said, "Well, governor, maybe it's better that some computers got stolen and the more people got killed. Property is less important than life." And the governor said, "What on earth are you talking about? You wouldn't allow the crowd to go rampaging into your building and steal your computers, would you?" From that moment onwards, any trust between us and the Iraqi governor was lost. And the problem there was not a problem of planning, it wasn't a problem of tactics, it wasn't a problem of implementation. It had nothing to do with what Rumsfeld thought he was doing in Washington. It was a fundamental clash of different visions of politics. Firstly, of course, this disagreement about the human rights, whether or not crowds should be allowed to gather outside a building. Secondly, of course, our sympathy for the crowd, our lack of trust for the Iraqi governor. Crowd-carrying banners saying the governor is corrupt, nepotistic, incompetent, and indeed the governor was all those things. But finally, and most dramatically, the fact that the British soldiers, in the end, did not think that either their public or their politicians would put up with their soldiers being killed in order to defend a piece of empty property, nor were they prepared to stand there killing Iraqis in front of BBC television cameras. In other words, in the most stark terms, we are not prepared to define the conditions under which we're prepared to kill Iraqis or the conditions under which we're prepared to have our own soldiers killed, quite understandably, because the business of occupation is a very nasty, messy business.
And you remind us there was a huge difference when Britain was the occupier over 10 years, and it still failed.
And it still failed. The British in 1916, my predecessors in Amaro, they spoke fluent Arabic, they'd spent 20 years running provinces in British India, they were unhampered by any concerns about human rights or BBC television cameras. And yet, in 1920, my predecessor in Al-Amara, Colonel Leachman, went up to Fallujah to try to deal with the revolution there, and he was shot in the back by a sheikh. And outside my office was a bronze statue of Colonel Leachman being shot in the back. And there were soap operas on television about Colonel Leachman being shot in the back.
Do you think the problem was in the management of the war by Donald Rumsfeld?
No. Not particularly that I'm a great supporter of Donald Rumsfeld, but simply because this project was doomed from the beginning. It didn't go wrong because we didn't plan properly or because we abolished the Iraqi army or because we got rid of the Ba'ath Party. This was undoable, basically because it turned out the Iraqi population didn't consent to this occupation. And when I hear all we have to do is fiddle with the tactics or change the strategy slightly, this is still winnable, I disagree totally. Of course it's true we didn't do it very well, but I'm, as a diplomat, somebody who's served in Indonesia working on East Timor, in Bosnia, in Kosovo, in Kabul, and the kinds of mistakes we're making in Iraq are no different from the kinds of mistakes that we make in all those places. They're mistakes which are in the nature of the kind of institutions we work for. They're big government agencies. They make the kind of mistakes that big government agencies make. Everybody says to me, "Why doesn't the electricity work in Baghdad?" Well, I know it still doesn't work in Kosovo 7 years after the invasion, after $1 billion has been spent there. We're just not very good at doing those things. But the basic problem in Iraq is not that. The basic problem is that in those other countries, the population give us the benefit of the doubt.
And they want the coalition or whatever the forces are there because they've also decided that this is the path they want to take.
Absolutely. The problem in Iraq is that people in Iraq believe the electricity doesn't work because we're deliberately trying to humiliate the Iraqi people. I had the dean of the science faculty of Baghdad University visiting me in Harvard last year. And he said to me, "In Nasiriyah, there is enough electricity for the whole of Iraq. You are withholding it from Iraq." And I said, "It's not true. The demand is 12,000 megawatts. We've just refurbished the Nasiriyah power generation station." And he said, "My friend, let me tell you, I know that in Nasiriyah, there is enough electricity for the whole of Iraq, and you're withholding it." And my conclusion for that is, wait a second, if the dean of the science faculty of the best university in the country doesn't believe me, I mean, what on earth do the 80 or 90% of people on the street think?
You're reminding me they also thought coalition forces, you were withholding the red mercury.
Right. They believed that we had put our office over a seam of this substance called red mercury. It's doubtful whether red mercury actually exists. It's some kind of semi-fictional substance which Iraqis believe are used for making a new generation of super bomb. In demonstration after demonstration, there were huge leaflets being given to me saying, "Give us back our red mercury." And this is the fundamental problem in Iraq. If people are saying, give us jobs, give us roads, we could imagine a policy which could deliver those things. If people are saying, give us red mercury, give us back our manhood, well, these are not things we can deliver.
But how are things there now? You've returned.
I've returned, and my real surprise was to find in Nasiriyah the most stable and secure part of Iraq. Why? Well, ironically, it's become like that because the coalition does nothing there. It's freed up Iraqi politicians to strike compromises with their opponents and enemies. It's taken the popularity and legitimacy away from the insurgency because there are no foreign troops to attack. And I think it's an encouraging model for the whole of Iraq. My instincts are that Iraqi politicians are much more competent, much cannier, much more flexible than we acknowledge, and will be able to improve the situation in Iraq if we leave.
Rory Stewart, his new book, The Prince of the Marshes and Other Occupational Hazards of the Year in Iraq. Rory, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, coming up, a military view of Iraq. And tomorrow we'll speak with reporter Michael Weisskopf. He lost a hand in Iraq, but gained a bond with soldiers there. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Funding. It's here and now. A day after stunning the world with news that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is resigning, President Bush met with his cabinet this morning and had this to say about the war, bipartisanship, and what lies ahead.
Whatever party we come from, we all have a responsibility to ensure that these troops have the resources and support they need to prevail. I'm open to any idea or suggestion that will help us achieve our goals of defeating the terrorists and ensuring that Iraq's democratic government succeeds.
Well, will that result in any major changes in Iraq, and should it? We thought we'd ask one of Donald Rumsfeld's most surprising recent critics to talk to us about what's next for the Pentagon and the war in Iraq. Earlier this year, Colonel T.X. Hammes was one of a group of recently retired officers, among the first to speak out publicly against the defense secretary. In 2004, Colonel Hammes served in Iraq under Rumsfeld, and he joins us on the line from Carlisle, Pennsylvania. T.X., you said I can call you T.X., welcome back.
Thank you.
And your first reaction to the news of the resignation?
Well, I think it's good news. Secretary Rumsfeld obviously served the country to the best of his ability, but he was the wrong man at the wrong time. So his stepping down will now allow us to do the things we need to do to succeed in Iraq.
Well, we'll ask you if you think that now we have the right man at the right time. But first, more on Rumsfeld. He had been criticized for not planning the post-invasion, not recognizing the nature of the insurgency. And you said months ago, stay the course is not a strategy. So are you saying that sort of covers the entire conflict? Are you saying there's been no strategy at all in Iraq?
No, there's been no strategy in Washington, D.C. The strategy in Iraq was clear, hold, build, which was developed by the ambassador and General Casey. That works. The problem is in Washington, D.C., they didn't support the build part. They took away the funding for build. They didn't support the hold part because they never supported the Iraqi army. Believe it or not, today the Iraqi army is still traveling mostly in unarmored pickup trucks, and they have insufficient numbers of advisors. There may be 10 advisors per battalion. There should probably be about 60. It would require a massive investment on the part of the Army and the Marine Corps, but it's necessary. And on the clear strategy, of course, we've never really had a sufficient number of U.S. troops, but at this point we may have damaged the Army and Marine Corps so badly it would be very difficult to get the correct number.
Well, what do you think? I would just want to ask you to comment on, I'm not sure if you had a chance to hear it, but we just had Rory Stewart, the British diplomat who was an interim governor in some of the provinces in the South. And he has come to the conclusion that no occupation was ever going to be successful, that it was the invasion that was the problem. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think the invasion was a stupid thing to do. The problem is, we're there now. It's nice to have any discussion you want about whether it was smart or not, but the fact is we're there. Now the question is, what do we do that causes the minimum damage both to U.S. national interest and world interests?
Well, he does say, and just to get your thoughts on this, he does say that having visited again Nasiriyah, he says what to do is leave because he says, in fact, the politicians that were fighting when he was there have now been forced to make compromises.
That may be the case down south where he's got that condition. The problem we've got in Baghdad is that there's a growing Sunni-Shia civil war. The primary concern I have is if we pull out suddenly, that civil war spreads to the greater Middle East. And civil wars are very brutal by their nature and go after each other's resources. So obviously some of the prime Sunni resources are Kuwaiti and Saudi oil fields.
Well, let's talk
more
about
important production facilities.
Well, let's talk about what some of the possibilities are. Democrats coming into power in Washington have said the first order of business will be legislation calling for an undetermined, not all, but an undetermined number of troops to come home immediately. The Iraq Study Group that Bob Gates, who's Robert Gates, rather, former CIA head, who is Mr. Rumsfeld's replacement. He's also a member of the Iraq Study Group. They're not expected to call for pulling out of Iraq quickly. Democrat John Murtha has said he thinks the commission will propose pulling U.S. troops away from this daily crossfire of sectarian warfare, this looming civil war. Your thoughts on some of these suggestions?
Well, I think the problem with getting out from between the middle of the Civil War is we were doing that this summer and we became irrelevant. The Bush administration since last January has been saying things which indicated to the Iraqis that we were leaving when he cut all money for the fund to fund the building of the Iraqi infrastructure, when he then came out with a budget that said we're going to cut the Army and the Marine Corps. I mean, the message is pretty clear. You're getting ready to get out of Iraq. That made the Iraqis look past us and start fighting each other harder. And this is not a new pattern. When the Soviets let it be known they were going to leave Afghanistan, the Afghan resistance stopped fighting the Soviets and started fighting each other.
Right.
That's a pattern in these conflicts. You'll note also that the Afghan Civil War continued from when the Soviets left in 89 through 92 when Najibullah fell, right up to 2001 when we invaded, and is still going on. That's the length of these civil wars. Now, it doesn't matter so much if it happens in Afghanistan, but if it happens in the broader Middle East and starts to really take down the oil infrastructure, we are not prepared to deal with that. We've had 30 years to get off of oil. We haven't done anything, and now we are where we are.
Well, what do you think that Bob Gates can do to quickly limit the damage?
Well, the first thing is put the Pentagon on a wartime footing. It's essentially on a peacetime footing. For instance, although our troops are very short of equipment to train on to go overseas, and much of the equipment they have in Iraq is not the best available in the world, we're still treating it as a peacetime problem. Our repair depots, where the equipment's backed up for repair, are only working normal 8-hour shifts. We are not buying the best available armored equipment to send overseas. All of those things would have been unacceptable in World War II. The Bush administration keeps saying this is the biggest challenge of our generation. We should start treating it like that.
It sounds with that you're saying, go all the way in Iraq. Put more effort into it.
We're certainly put more money into it. I mean, it is immoral to send young men and women over there to fight for us and not give them decent equipment.
When you've already said, sort of slow withdrawal or half withdrawal would promote a disaster, how about immediate withdrawal?
I think that would be the biggest disaster because that really breaks into out-and-out bloodshed. The problem is we have become irrelevant. We have not trained Iraqi security forces to be effective. So the problem for the average Iraqi is they have to turn to the militia for protection. There is no one else to protect your family.
I got one last question.
It happens everywhere in the world.
I have one quick question in the we went about a minute and a half, and I'm wondering, are you concerned about a former CIA head leading the military now? Critics of the administration say there's been too little accountability over allegations that of torture. And under newly signed legislation, the CIA can still harshly interrogate terror suspects. So are you concerned?
I think it's not a bad thing for a CIA guy to lead the war because he understands it's more about humans than technology. The part about torture is Congress needs to look into that. I mean, given the law that they passed was pretty silly, Congress needs to look into that and get us back on the path of flat-out Americans don't torture. It doesn't work, and it's bad for our image worldwide.
Are you feeling hopeful?
Mildly optimistic. We still have the same president. We still have the same senior military leadership, and the bureaucracy in the Pentagon is huge and resistant to change. So it's going to take a very major effort on the part of the new secretary with full backing of the president in order to make this thing work.
Retired Marine Colonel T.X. Hamas, he served in Iraq in 2004, one of the first military leaders to speak out against Donald Rumsfeld, also author of The Sling and the Stone on War in the 21st Century. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks a lot.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, Donald Rumsfeld got into some famous verbal sparring matches. In December of 2004, Army Specialist Thomas Wilson of the Tennessee National Guard questioned Rumsfeld about the lack of armor on Humvees.
Our vehicles are not armored. We're digging pieces of rusted scrap metal and compromised ballistic glass that's already been shot up, dropped, busted, picking the best out of this scrap to put onto our vehicles to take into combat.
As you know, you go to war with the army you have, not the army you might want or wish to have at a later time.
Brian Hart of Bedford, Massachusetts, watched that exchange on television. A year earlier, his 20-year-old son, John, had been killed in Iraq, shot while driving in an unarmored Humvee. Just days before John died, he'd called home, telling his dad that he felt exposed and worrying it was only a matter of time before his unit would be ambushed. Well, for one parent's point of view, Brian Hart joins us now. And Brian, tell us, when you heard Rumsfeld's remarks to the soldier about armor, what was your reaction? And what was your reaction yesterday when you heard that Rumsfeld was resigning?
Well, we had been lobbying for well over a year by that point, my wife and I, for better equipment for the troops. And he could have been a hero. Rumsfeld could have said, I'm going to go back to the office, find out what's going wrong, and I'm going to fix it. But instead, you know, he came across as a heel. You know, his epitaph, in my opinion, is going to be too little too late.
Your son called you just before he was killed, and he knew of the problems. Tell us about that conversation.
Well, if a lowly PFC in south of Kirkuk could call and say that, ask his parents to help him get some equipment on their Humvee and for their body armor, you know that the Secretary of Defense has better information than he does. Yet, you know, the fact is, I think Rumsfeld's legacy is that, you know, he will have lost the war in Iraq.
And the description of your son's death is pretty awful. They had some flimsy covering on the Humvee they were in, and trying to cover themselves with, I think, pieces of Kevlar.
Yeah, they just got shot up. Not enough ammunition, no armor, in a hopeless situation. And that's the shame. I mean, you have these wonderful troops and this leadership in the Pentagon that's essentially losing this war. You know, I wish this country needs a George Marshall, but, you know, I think while I'm all for Gates coming in, I hope he's not, you know, some Cold War hand-me-down.
Well, you say George Marshall is in the Marshall Plan, and, yeah. And adding to what you've been saying, the Washington Post wrote that another soldier with your son, his training cost about $400,000 to put him in the field, but he died because of the lack of a $20 tourniquet. Do you think that Mr. Gates, if confirmed as the new Secretary of Defense, will change things?
I hope so. I think I'm fairly optimistic that an honest man that's competent could do wonders at this point.
We just heard from Rory Stewart, who was a British diplomat who was in charge of trying to pull the southern province in Iraq together, and he's come to the conclusion that the invasion never should have happened, that you have to have a population that's willing to be occupied, Japan, for instance, to restart. Do you worry that the whole mission
could have been in vain? It's possible. We need to position ourselves in Iraq as protecting, you know, our own national interests and the human rights of Iraq and its neighbors. I think that means that liberators leave. Put simply, you know, Iraqis have to fight for their own freedom at some point. And if Iraq breaks up into three pieces, then so be it. We have to focus on what the ideals that make America great and have a reality-based policy in order to have any hope of salvaging the situation in Iraq. This country, under Rumsfeld, never actually engaged in the war. He never brought the country into the fight, and I'm afraid we'll lose it because of that.
Brian Hart's son, John, was killed in combat in Iraq after his unarmored Humvee was ambushed in October of 2003. Brian, thanks so much for speaking with us again. We appreciate it.
Hey, you know, I think it's a good day.
You do.
I do, don't you? There's an opportunity here, I think that we have this small window of opportunity to have a real discussion.
Brian, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. Robin Young, it's here and now. M.T. Anderson's new book, Octavian Nothing, Traitor to the Nation, was recently named a finalist in the Young Adult Fiction category of the National Book Awards. At the beginning of the book, the young boy at the center, Octavian, thinks he's living an enchanted life in what turns out to be pre-revolutionary Boston. He and his mother, Cassiopeia, an African princess, are cared for by men so magical they could be wizards.
The men who raised me were lords of matter, and in the dim chambers I watched as they traced the spinning of bodies celestial in vast iron courses, and bid sparks to dance upon their hands. They read the bodies of fish as if each dying trout or shad was a fresh biblical testament, the wet and twitching volume of a newborn Pentateuch. They burned holes in the air, wrote poems of love, sucked the venom from sores, painted landscapes of gloom, and made metal sing. They dissected fire like newts.
Ah, but Octavian soon discovers he may be an African prince, but he and his mother were sold as slaves and are, in fact, human lab rats. Those lords of matter are, in fact, scientists studying Octavian to see if blacks are inferior to whites. And what feels futuristic is, in fact, taking place in Boston right before the American Revolution, an event that Octavian will soon become caught up in. It is at times a deeply disturbing, breathtaking plunge into a Boston more gothic than fife and drum. An inverse Harry Potter. Harry Potter lives a lowly life and then discovers he has magic. Octavian starts off wearing silks and, after escaping the scientists, ends up crawling in the mud alongside Minutemen. Well, author M.T. Anderson joins us in the studio with more about this fantastical story. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I'm told I can call you Tobin.
Please do.
Okay, what a read. Is this true? The whole time I wanted to know, is this true? Was there such an experimental society, for instance, in Boston?
There were experimental societies of this kind. The largest of them, though, was in Philadelphia, and they did not carry on this particular experiment. There were versions of this experiment carried on, I believe, at Harvard in the late 17th century. There was an attempt to do this kind of thing with Native Americans. And then I think also at the College of William and Mary, they also did a similar experiment to see if Native Americans could pick up classical education.
How would you characterize how these scientists feel about Octavian? Because at times in the beginning, they would seem to love him. They teach him languages and music. He plays the violin beautifully. But it's also punishing at times.
Well, it's that coldness of seeing someone merely as an experimental subject, so that it's hard to understand what they might be going through.
And yet again, you don't know that until this story starts to unfold. And then, Octavian's mother gets a stark reminder that she is indeed a slave, and without giving anything away, at times this is often so dark. Is it a book for young readers? What age would you put it at?
I don't know. I actually did not think about the age when I was writing it, because it seemed to me so important to try to capture what the character would say rather than to corral him in a particular direction.
And what do you think now, having written it?
Well, I feel like I would definitely say that it would be for 16 and older.
Right. Yeah. Because we said it's very dark. But it also has elements, and ask you about that, has elements of the fantastical, the books that kids are reading, the Harry Potter and such. Did you do that purposefully?
Definitely. One of the ideas of writing the book was that I wanted to kind of conceal from the reader where the setting was and what period it was in, because I feel like we know our national myths so well that it's very hard for us to understand how that period might have appeared to those who didn't yet know that the revolution, for example, would be won by this set of colonists, and who didn't know that they were going to sunder themselves from this massive empire. What I wanted to do was to try to create a kind of a gothic setting that seemed almost like a fairy tale, and then gradually to have the reader recognize, just as the character does, that the situation is not what they expect, right, and that really they're in a familiar place, but looking at it from a very unfamiliar angle.
That's exactly what happens. As Octavian goes from 4 to 5 to 6 years old, the scales start to drop away from his eyes, and he sees and we see that he really is in colonial New England. And there are events that take place. We don't want to give away too much of the storyline. And Octavian ends up running away and becomes a part of the Revolutionary War. Now we're suddenly in a very different book. Now he's crawling along in the mud, as we said, alongside other fighters. Tell us what you wanted to express there.
One of the things is, and this is covered more in the second volume of the book, because there are two volumes in all, I really wanted to highlight the complicated set of decisions that people were making in that period, once again, before they knew what it meant to be an American or to think of yourself as anything other than a British citizen. So I wanted to say, what kind of decision would this character make about which side he was going to fight on?
We've spoken on this program with Gary Nash, author of the terrific book, The Forgotten Fifth, African Americans in the Age of Revolution. And we talked at that time about the unbelievable hypocrisy of the colonists. They were fighting for their freedom, but they didn't want that to extend to their slaves. And the British, on the other hand, offered freedom to the slaves who would cross over and fight for them. So there was, and you write beautifully about this, there was this fear on the part of the colonists that any day they'd wake up and their slaves would revolt against them.
The American attitude towards African Americans and their rank in general was very, very complicated throughout the war. One of the first things that Washington did when he arrived at Cambridge, Massachusetts, during the siege of Boston, was that he forbade African Americans from being enlisted because he was far too worried about the idea of black men with guns. Another thing, for example, General Sumter later on in the war was literally giving away slaves to those who would enlist in the American army as a premium for enlistment.
And American slaves could fight instead of their owners. They could be sent to take the place of their owners.
Exactly, right. And so you have a system like this, and yet at the other hand, you look at it and you say, but this was also, it ended up being the most integrated army ethnically that America had up until the time of the Vietnam War.
As I said in the beginning, at the outset, this is not your quaint little fife and drum tale. It's Dickensian. I mean, it's just, it can be dark.
Well, and, you know, because the period could be. It was a very long and bitter war, really. There's a startling statistic, and these statistics are hard to actually get very precisely, but something like 4,500 people died in battle. And something like 60,000 people died of starvation and disease. And that gives you a sense that the simple heroism of the war that we picture, the sort of the men in wigs and nice-looking coats with the shafts of light falling down upon them from the heavens, that is less part of this war than the horrors that people were going through on a day-to-day basis, just trying to get food in freezing camp situations, walking without shoes through the snow. The heroism of the people, both of our country and of Britain's empire, it comes through, I think, even more when you think of the hideous conditions under which the war was fought.
Yeah. Well, this is Volume 1. It's called The Pox Party because before he escapes, Octavian joins all the scientists and they get smallpox vaccinations. This was very common at the time. It was a party, only some people ultimately die of the pox. Meanwhile, the subtitle of the book is Traitor to the Nation. In the second volume, does he join the British?
Yeah, what happens in book two, one of the things that happens is that he joins Lord Dunmore's Ethiopian Regiment, which was a real regiment raised in Virginia as an attempt to pull support away from the Patriots and gain a kind of immediate British army down there of freed African-American slaves.
Well, we cannot wait. When does that come out?
Well, it comes out next year, so long as I get revising.
M.T. Anderson, author of The Astonishing Life of Octavian Nothing, Traitor to the Nation, Volume 1, The Pox Party, his story of Octavian Nothing, the slave at the center of an extraordinary study and story. Tobin Anderson, thanks so much for speaking with us about it.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
And good luck with that National Book Award.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.